Welcome to the Nightly Five podcast with Ben O'Shea.
On today's show, the bombshell finding was handed down in the defamation case Bruce Lerman launched against Network 10 and Lisa Wilkinson. And spoiler alert, it was a spectacular own goal for one of the parties. Plus, as New South Wales is still reeling over the Bondi Junction massacre on Saturday, I talked to a criminologist about what the police will do next. Former cricket star Michael Slater fronted a court today on domestic violence offences, and Twiggy Forrest's charity is shedding jobs. And we'll leave you today with the wash-up from a big weekend in sport. In our top story today, Bruce Lerman's spectacular own goal.
Mr. Lerman raped Miss Higgins.
It took 2.5 hours for Justice Michael Lee to read out his judgment in the defamation case Bruce Lerman launched against Network 10 and Lisa Wilkinson. 2.5 hours that will forever label Bruce Lerman a rapist.
Mr. Lerman, what's your response to being a rapist?
That was the huge media throng faced by Lerman as he left the court today. He kept his head down and refused to answer any questions. Justice Lee found that on the balance of probabilities, Lerman raped Higgins on a couch in the office of then-Minister Linda Reynolds in Parliament in 2019. Then, having escaped the lion's den...
Mr. Lerman made the mistake of coming back for his hat.
Covering the trial today is Chief Reporter at The Nightly, Sarah Blake. Sarah, what were Justice Lee's findings in terms of the defamation case?
Well, what Justice Lee found is that Bruce Lerman was not a man to be believed. So he took this action because he wanted to restore his reputation after he said that Channel 10 and Lisa Wilkinson had defamed him by describing him as a rapist. And the most extraordinary thing, of course, is that Lerman was free from all of this. He had literally escaped from jail on rape charges when that earlier trial over the 2019 rape of Brittany Higgins was abandoned because of jury misconduct. And he went back to seek money, it would appear, and it was really one of the most spectacular own goals in recent legal history in Australia.
Yeah, and Justice Lee looked like he took some enjoyment in pointing that out to Bruce Lerman today. How did he come to the conclusion that a rape had occurred?
He found that the rape had occurred because Brittany had consumed so much alcohol, a lot of it at the urging of Bruce Lerman, that she wasn't in a position to give consent.
Mm. Yeah, he made it pretty clear that that was the conclusion that he came to based on the probabilities. The words "more likely than not" were used quite a lot by Justice Lee. And he also spoke about the difference between a criminal case and a civil case in terms of evidence. So how is this decision different to, say, a finding in a criminal case that Lerman had raped Brittany Higgins?
Yes, he had to find that on the balance of probabilities that the rape had occurred, so he didn't have to find it was beyond a reasonable doubt. I think one of the other really interesting things that he spoke about was that Brittany had, you know, I mentioned before that Brittany had, there'd been some inconsistencies in her story. And what he spoke about was the fact that a lot of this was related to the trauma that she'd experienced. And he was at pains to make that point that there isn't a specific way that someone who was a victim of rape should respond, because that had been a big part of Lerman's legal team. They had really pushed that point that her behaviour was at odds with someone who had been raped. So that was another interesting part of the judgment today.
Mm. And so technically it's a win for Network 10 and Lisa Wilkinson. They off the hook for defamation, although Justice Lee did have some criticism for them in how they behaved in this case and the influence they may have had on the mistrial of the criminal case against Bruce Lerman. So what happens now? Because obviously there'll be costs to pay. This is undoubtedly an expensive trial.
Yeah, that's right. So Bruce Lerman is on the nut for a lot of money. I was speaking to one of the lawyers for Channel 10 after court today, and he said it wasn't, you know, definite that Channel 10 would be pursuing Lerman to the point of bankruptcy. But, you know, the some of these silks who these legal these parties have engaged charge, you know, $10,000, $15,000 a day. So we're talking multi-million million legal fees to cover this. So both Ten and Lisa Wilkinson will now submit their costs arguments in April, and from then there'll be a ruling about how they'll be covered.
And there was a fine way to end this outside the courtroom today in Sydney. Justin Quill, one of Ten's solicitors, was asked if he had any advice for Bruce Lerman, who's studying law at university. Justin Quill, the lawyer for Network 10, said Lerman should take up another course at university. Pretty good advice indeed, because his legal advice in this case did not go too well at all. Chief reporter at The Nightly, Sarah Blake, thanks for giving us this update.
Thanks.
Sydney is tonight a city still in shock, grappling to come to terms with a senseless killing spree here at Bondi Junction in the city's east. Six lives were cut short inside the Westfield shopping centre by a man armed with a hunting knife, the 15-minute frenzy only ending when he was fatally gunned down by a hero police officer.
Australia, and definitely New South Wales, are still reeling from the events of Saturday at Bondi Junction. Joel Couchy, a Queensland man with mental health problems, had moved from Queensland to New South Wales only a month before he took a knife into a crowded Sydney shopping centre. He killed six people and wounded others, including a nine-month-old baby, in an unprovoked stabbing spree before he was eventually stopped when fatally shot by a police officer. But what happens now? Here to help us understand the next steps in this dark chapter of Australian history is Associate Professor in Criminal Justice and Criminology at Bond University, Terry Goldsworthy. Professor Goldsworthy, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, good afternoon.
And so New South Wales Police has launched Strike Force Macaulay to look into the Bondi Junction massacre. Can you give us an idea of what that will involve?
Well, I mean, it's just they're going to move through the investigative process. So any investigation generally moves from a low information state up to a high information state. So that is what the drive of the task force will be. I mean, we've kind of moved through the crime scene stage, which occurred over the weekend, where the police declared the whole shopping centre a crime scene, and there would have been multiple crime scenes within that area that they've processed in terms of forensics and physical material, et cetera. So now what they'll be doing, I guess, is going through seeking witnesses. I saw this morning they've had another 50 witnesses come forward today, so they'll be, I suspected, a range of hundreds of witness statements that they'll need to take in terms of what people saw. They'll be gathering CCTV from the various stores, the shopping centre itself, and also any private video footage that people may have taken of the incident. And that'll just give them, I guess, a picture or record of what occurred at the shopping centre. And then probably the most important stage that they'll then have to do is going and looking at what was the motivation of the offender in this instance. And to do that, they'll need to go back and speak to associates, to family, etc., to see what his interactions with police in the past have been, although Queensland Police indicate that he had no criminal interactions with them. And that will allow them to determine, I guess, what his motivation may have been. I mean, we do know he had some mental health issues, etc. So that will be important of itself to seeing what mental health professionals interacted with him can tell police investigators.
And beyond just trying to unpack why this horrific incident happened, are there other goals of an investigation like this?
Well, certainly they'll be looking at what unfolded once the attack occurred and began. And by that I'm talking about, you know, this is what we call an active armed offender scenario. So they'll be looking to see, you know, what could have been done better in terms of prevention, what could have been done in terms of preparedness and their response in relation to this. So we saw from the video footage that came out over the weekend that people evacuated from the centre. Now, I don't know if that was driven by an announcement or whatever else. There was one of the deceased was a security guard. Now, that interaction with the offender will be interesting to see. Was he reacting as part of their response plan to this person coming in armed? We saw shops closing up and bringing people inside the shops as they closed. They are all crucial things when you're talking about an active armed offender because, you know, if they have time and freedom of movement, then that leads to increased casualties. And we saw members of the public who interacted with the offender quite bravely stopping his ability to move freely, which would have saved many people, I suspect, by slowing him down or stopping him and then directing the police officer to where he was so she could take action to cease his rampage.
And so what do you think would be a likely timeline for this investigation to conclude and then information to be made public?
Oh, look, I think the investigation will probably be going for at least 6, maybe 12 months as they go through things. I mean, I'm not sure how many staff they're going to allocate to it and for how long, but I wouldn't be surprised if in 12 months they're getting towards the end of finalising all their inquiries. You know, and part of that will be, as you said, you know, not only looking at his motivations, but, you know, how did the police respond? Because they're going to have to investigate the police shooting. That's a separate investigation that will take place alongside the other homicide investigations to make sure that the use of the firearm is correct and within their guidelines and face value. I wouldn't see any issues there. But, you know, the police response on these type of issues, you know, the focus on the police response for active armed offenders is to reduce or suppress the threat posed by an active armed offender. So we saw that in the police officer moving through. She wasn't stopping for casualties or to speak to people. She was focused on getting to the threat, which is what their policy dictates, that they need to keep moving past those type of issues and get to the offender so they can stop the offender as quickly as possible.
Yeah, so it sounds like it might take a while before we get the results of Strike Force Macaulay, but those results will definitely be very important for everyone to hear and hopefully help the police handle or prevent future incidents should they arise. Associate Professor in Criminal Justice and Criminology at Bond University, Terry Goldsworthy, thanks for sharing these insights on the Nightly Five.
Thank you.
That's Michael Slater in the commentary box. Today, the former Australian Test cricketer was remanded in police custody after being charged with more than a dozen offences. Slater, who's 54 years old, had his case mentioned in Maroochydore Magistrates Court on Monday. He was arrested on 19 charges relating to alleged offences perpetrated on Queensland's Sunshine Coast on various dates between December 5, 2023 and April 12. The charges include domestic violence offences of unlawful stalking or intimidation, breaking into a dwelling with intent at night, common assault, assault occasioning bodily harm and choking or suffocation. The former opening batsman and TV commentator was also charged with breaching bail. Slater has been remanded in custody with the case due to be mentioned in the same court tomorrow. After making his debut during the 1993 Ashes tour, Slater played 74 tests for Australia, amassing 5,312 runs at an average of 42.83 with 14 centuries. He also played 42 one-day internationals. Slater retired from cricket in 2004, embarking on a successful TV commentary career. Now that career is most definitely in doubt. If you are experiencing domestic, family and sexual violence, help is available by calling 1-800-RESPECT. That's 1-800-737-732.
The Mindaroo Foundation was established in 2001 to identify and scale solutions that give a hand up, not a hand out.
They say charity begins at home. Well, maybe not if your home is the philanthropic arm of Andrew and Nicola Forrest's empire. About one third of jobs at the Mindaroo Foundation will be made redundant following a sweeping internal review of the organisation by Chief Executive John Hartman. Mindaroo was founded by Andrew and Nicola Forrest in 2001, and they today released an update to its 2030 strategy, which was initially rolled out last year. It's believed Mindaroo's headcount ballooned to 350 staff prior to Mr. Hartman being appointed boss in the latter half of 2022. About 100 staff will either be let go or have their roles altered in the latest restructure, with several international offices to be consolidated. It's understood the changes have been made for Mindaroo to boost the proportion of resources directed to beneficiaries from between 50 to 60% as it currently stands to at least 70 to 80%. Andrew and Nicola Forrest remain co-chairs on the Mindaroo board despite announcing last year they had separated after 31 years of marriage. A month prior to the announcement, the duo donated $5 billion worth of Fortescue stock, equal to about one-fifth of their shareholding, to Mindaroo. Mindaroo is involved in a variety of charitable pursuits, including investigating ocean pollution, stamping out modern slavery, and university research.
Talked about a lopsided penalty count, 10-1 in six agains, and then reckons that the Chevy charge down was offside.
He's on another planet, mate. If he's critical of the six agains and the penalties, he's on another planet.
There's a war of words that has erupted between Ricky Stewart and Des Hasler over the refereeing in their clash on the weekend. Here to help us unpack that and all the sports news is sports editor at The Nightly, Ben McClellan. All right, so who got it right, Ricky or Desi?
Probably neither of them, I would dare say. Wasn't so much a war of words as it was a Ricky Sticky Stewart offensive on Hasler. So the Raiders won an enthralling game against the Titans with a field goal win to steal the victory. The Titans are in a very bad way at the moment. Des Hasler was in his post-match press conference because the losing team generally goes first. Was highly critical of the female referee. And then Ricky, when he heard about these comments, as you just heard on that audio, made the, rather insightful jibe that he must be from another planet. And then he went into detail all the things that the referee could have picked up on the Titans, went on talking about wrestling in the ruck. So it's really not a good look. I mean, Ricky Stewart is a renowned whinger when it comes to post-match press conferences. So a little rich for him to get stuck into Dez. But yeah, obviously the Titans are in a struggling, and so Dez was understandably frustrated. And as unfortunately is the way too often in NRL, the coaches focus a lot on the refereeing and not so much on their own team, as you rarely hear from a winning team too many criticisms of the referee.
No, absolutely. And talking about criticism, yep. Spud Carroll, a new NRL columnist at the Nightly, is fired up about his former club, South Sydney Rabbitohs. We'll be speaking about them a lot lately. Yep. And as predicted, they didn't go well against Cronulla on the weekend.
It was a pretty gutsy loss. So
A moral victory,
you could possibly say. They went down to Cronulla. They put in a spirited second half. They lost numerous players to injury, and basically their bench was decimated. In the NRL, if you lose one or two guys off your bench, let alone three, then you're in a pretty bad way. They were left with just Tom Burgess, who I think just continually came on and off the field because he was the only one on the bench. They had players in all different positions. So Cronulla got the chocolates. Jason Demetriou, there was some pretty interesting photos of him, essentially screaming in the box. He could, could see the pressure's well and truly got to him. He was sort of upbeat in the post-match press conference. Might be living in a state of denial, talking about how his job wasn't under threat. He hadn't heard anything, even though one of the Rabbitohs bosses, Nick Politis, was saying that before the game, if they lost, then the club would have to look at things. And Spud Carroll, who's a Manly and a South player, has, really got stuck into the players in the Nightly edition tonight, saying that none of them have really stepped up. None of them have really taken the blame. And, it's up to the players to prove they want to keep Jason as the coach by improving their performance, which, of course, they're not at the moment. As he observes, the coach isn't the one missing tackles. The coach isn't the one dropping the ball.
Yeah, it's funny how that always seems to be the case. We'll see how we go. They'll need more than a moral victory, though, Jason Demetriou to keep his job. Over in the AFL, some big games on the weekend. The Giants had a big win over the Saints. Adelaide upset the Blues, 100-98. Port Adelaide, who we spoke about last week, they had a win over the Dockers. Interestingly, Port Adelaide will come up against Collingwood this coming weekend, and the Pies were struggling, but now Nick Dacos reckons those struggles are a thing of the past.
Yeah. Well, he's saying that he thinks they're sort of getting back to their best at a press event today. Said they're sort of, rediscovering the DNA that made them such a great club last year. The Pies had a pretty well-timed break. So that's given them a week off to sort of recharge their jets. There's a question mark over Scott Pendlebury, who was injured in their last game and obviously is, fighting that battle of age, which he's never going to win, whether he'll play this weekend. Port, one of the form teams of the competition. They're sporting probably the best midfield in the AFL at the moment, which is an area the Pies have always prided themselves on, particularly Dacos. It'll be interesting where he plays, whether he plays in the midfield or plays in the back line. But, yeah, so Nick was, you know, slightly confident that he feels like they're getting back to their best, and that'll really be proven when they play Port Adelaide this weekend.
Yeah, Saturday at the MCG, if the Pies can knock off Port, I reckon Dacos might have a point. I reckon the Pies will be back. Mm-hmm. Ben McClellan, sports editor of The Nightly, thanks as always. And that, folks, is today's show. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and join me tomorrow on The Nightly Five.
The Nightly Five podcast is brought to you by Seven West Media. For all these stories and more, head to thenightly.com.au, helping you get in front of tomorrow.